This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 843. It's around the holidays now when this is going up. I mean, you may listen to this in July of 2019. I don't know when this is. And if it is July of 2019 and you listen to this, you just shit your pants because I said that. So clean yourself up and continue listening because this is a very special episode. Ian McShane, who I'm a huge fan of. I fucking loved Deadwood. And Ian's just one of those guys that when he's in something, you just can't take your eyes off him. So I was delighted that he decided to come into the Nerdist Podcast studio and chat with me. But let me tell you about some corkboard stuff first. Chris Gable writes, "My friends and I have a podcast called Grown Up Human Comic People, and our show covers comics and life issues, complete with drinking and swearing. What we do is unique because we focus on comics that are just starting out to give them a bump to new authors and comic artists. We can be found on all podcast marketplaces for free, as well as Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, and Instagram. The website is grownuphumans.com. And the major players are Daniel, Dan, Greg, Jared, Becky, and Chris. So there you go, Grown Up Human Comic People. Also, LA's comedy festival Riot LA is coming up in January 19th through the 22nd. It's downtown LA, and this year's list of performers is insane. You can see Mel Brooks, yes, Mel Brooks, Maria Bamford, Jonathan Katz, Ali Wong, Eugene Merman, Nikki Glaser, Kyle Kinane, Tig Notaro, Adam Devine, Rachel Bloom, Whitney Cummings, Todd Berry, Bobcat Goldthwait, so many more amazing comics as well. Tickets and info can be found at riotla.com. So here we go. This is Nerdist Podcast number 843 with Ian McShane, who is promoting The Hollow Point, which is in theaters December 16th. So you should absolutely have Patrick Wilson is also in that, the movie looks amazing. So check it out. Look at the trailer on YouTube. Go see the movie this weekend. Here's the Nerdist Podcast with Ian McShane. Katie, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
It's the holiday season.
There's eight little ones inside them.
It's a nesting chocolate. They just get smaller and smaller and smaller. Do you need anything? Are you good?
Water's fine. No, I'm fine.
Excellent.
What are you guys shooting afterwards? Are you doing a magazine cover?
No, what are we doing?
George
Pinocchio, I think, with him.
George, oh, cool.
Up in, yeah, for ABC, whatever, yeah.
Very cool. Well, welcome. Thanks for coming all the way to our studio in the middle of town. But
I live at the beach. I just got back from New York yesterday, last night, and I live at the beach, so it was nice. Go down to Venice, unpack. My wife went to Detroit to see her mom, so I got up 5 o'clock this morning, did the washing, Chris. Yes, you do.
You know? Yeah, as you have to.
I like machine those machines, you know? Getting back into it, a little bit of that, a little bit of bleach.
You do your...
Got up, did a walk on the beach, and then went in for a... Yeah, got me to see you.
You're a do-your-own-laundry kind of guy.
Oh, well, yeah, in my day, you did. That's what you did, yeah.
You had to do your own.
And had to do your own.
Did you ever feel like that if you got to a point in your career where you refused to do your own laundry, that was going to be a problem? Like that, that you, do you feel, do you keep grounded by doing your own laundry?
Well, no, I've married three times and none of my wives do laundry, so. No, I was saying it's just important you do your own laundry and your own cooking. Well, yeah.
Be self-sufficient. What do you like to cook? What do you cook?
I haven't cooked much lately because I've been on the move, so I don't travel with a little hot plate and things like that. You know, people do. I think Jeremy Irons once said he traveled with a lot of scarves to make hotel rooms look like. I thought, where the hell did you come from, Jeremy? You know, a brothel in Istanbul somewhere. No, I don't travel with anything. I like the rooms to look like they are. No cooking. Well, it used to be difficult. I mean, I remember the old days when you do a play outside of London, you have nowhere to eat. You do a play, you finish and be like, you go to the local Chinese and have chow mein and chips.
Right.
After the theater. There's nowhere else open, either an Indian or a Chinese restaurant. No, now, of course, it's all everybody. They don't want to be in rock and roll. They want to be in cooking.
Right.
Chef, you know, or the shows on TV. But nobody cooks anymore. You know that. These cooking shows on TV, baking shows, cooking shows, they're hugely popular. But nobody actually.
People just like watching
people cook.
Exactly.
They buy the books, they give them Christmas, but nobody cooks anymore. Nobody cooks. They just go out. You know?
Well, have you been married since 1980?
Since
1980.
Yeah.
So, I just got married in August. What is some good, solid wedding advice?
Spend a lot of time apart. I have, especially in the bathroom. Especially in the bathroom. If you can, separate bathrooms. Very, very important.
You know, that's.
And if you smoke, you can always say, but you don't do that.
I don't.
Yeah. No, exactly. So you have problems saying, darling, I'm just going out for a cigarette. Like when you're on a film set with a bad actor or a boring person, you go, I'm just going out for a cigarette while you discuss your problems
with
the director.
So you just said that now. So if halfway through this, you're like, I'm just going to go for a smoke.
Yeah,
like,
well, I'll know what you're doing then.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm worried you're going to do that. I'm not going to do that.
I can't make the excuse.
I am very excited that, I mean, not only am I such a huge fan of yours, but also, I mean, Deadwood to me, you know, and my wife, incidentally, her great-great-grandfather was George Hurst.
Oh, my goodness.
And so she had never seen it. So when we first started dating, I was like, well, surely you've seen Deadwood. Oh, no, actually, I'd forgotten. And I said, have you seen Deadwood? And she goes, no, I think my great-great-grandfather's. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding? Oh, my God. And I showed it to her, and her reaction was, he was just misunderstood. Like, that was her reaction.
No, that's what I said about my character. She's stolen that line. Hers was a bad guy, you know that.
He was a really bad guy. He was misunderstood.
That's what they say about every bad character now.
No.
You're complicated.
It was a different time.
It's a different time. He just went in and got all the leases for the gold and the ore and, you know, screwed everybody that was in his way. An early Donald Trump.
Yeah. He's not the same.
Well, you've got Hearst Towers.
Yes, but that doesn't.
San Simeon's very strange.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah, it was such a strange feat in the, you know, in the early 1900s. Like, let's just build a castle there.
Bring it all over from Italy, whatever. Bring everything over and
from
ship
over.
It all in there.
It was just like an architectural salvage.
And in the end, all you wanted was a sled. Rosebud.
That was a movie was made by a hack director.
Oh, yeah. A real hack director.
Who just
he
was
only
doing a hatchet job on this very nice man.
I saw it again recently. It is pretty good, actually, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, but you know, what's remarkable to me is that how empathetic people were to Swearengen's character in that, because he I ostensibly should be like, well, he's kind of the bad guy, really. He's sort of the villain.
Well, I think the genius of the show is David Milch, who is a bona fide genius.
Yes.
The guy, I mean, it's all about him. I mean, he's the one that envisioned it. I mean, I remember when he first went in, I think he pitched them Rome, and they said, we're already doing a series about that. He said, fine. And his mind racing quickly, I'm on a Western. Then he came up, but what he came up with was really, it's the story of America. I mean, it's a very political show in terms of what it does is tells you how, if you like, a certain civilization is created. You know, there's a lot of bad guys, a lot of guys around. The girls who are around are all whores or whatever, or treated badly by the men, and suddenly civilization creeps in, law comes in, and we were just getting going when, you know, HBO, to their eternal shame, cancelled it. You know, well, that's hubris and ego, which happens in every business. There's 17 different versions of why did no more than three seasons, but thank God we had the three seasons. Well, it was a remarkable time, yeah.
Because it seemed like, obviously, to me, is one of the great tragedies of television is that just that last season just ends, and you're like, oh boy, shit's going to get crazy. What just happened?
What do I know?
But you guys thought it was coming back at the time.
Well, we've been told, and then suddenly, but of course they hadn't picked up those little slips of paper, which, a month. And before that happened, they canceled it. Who knows whatever went on. You'll hear 10 different stories of it. It was very expensive.
Yes.
It was very complicated. Milch works in a certain way, but it was definitely the best, I mean, I think, for all of us involved, because we still talk about it. I mean, there's talk about it now. They're writing a script. But, I'll believe it when I'm on that muddy street in my boots.
I know, looking at
Timothy Oliphant, both of us saying, are we here again doing it, or is it just a pipe dream?
I would see Kim Dickens quite a lot because she's doing that other Walking Dead show.
Yeah,
she's amazing.
Yeah,
and every time I see her, I'm like, you don't even know about Deadwood yet? She's like, I mean, we're dead. I hear about it, but I don't know.
Yeah,
exactly
we all hear,
I mean.
And then we get in touch, and then they say, David's writing a script. I mean, but, now would seem a perfect time. It's 10 years since they elbowed it. It's 10 years, it's kind of like it's perfect time. Tim's got a huge following from, the show he did, Justified.
Yeah.
All the other people are free. None of us will be free for much longer.
Right.
But maybe it is just, blowing smoke up our asses.
But
who
Swearengen,
knows?
They were all real people. Swearengen was
a
real
Swearengen,
guy.
Yeah, Swearengen was a real guy. And so was Bullock, who was a friend of, what do you call him? The first, what was your Theodore Roosevelt became a big friend of his and the Justice. It was all based on real stuff, but obviously Milch took his liberties with it, whatever. I don't think that probably that Swearengen, the original guy, was half as interesting as Milch wrote him to be, and got the gift of playing him.
Everyone was, it was like Old West Shakespeare.
Well, that's what Milch does. Milch's genius is that he didn't have me come down the stairs every week and kill somebody and make a long speech, which he would if it was on, normal TV. What he did was he built every guy and every woman on that show had their own individual personality. And it was the story of the town. And as the town grew, and how, Swearengen learned to live with Bullock. Bullock learned to live with him. It's like, you take care of your side of the street, I'll take care of mine. And then when Hearst came in, they both realized that's real power.
Yeah.
How do you deal with real power? You shut your fucking mouth until something happens. That's why it was all, you didn't have any big face-offs between Swearengen and Hearst. Because what? Well, Swearengen knew. It was ridiculous. He got the pleasure of killing one of his men, but that was it.
Oh, and by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that fight scene between your guy and his guy.
Oh, yeah, that was phenomenal.
And the genius part about it was how much it fucked him up for, because it's so graphic, and he rips the guy's eyeball out.
Yeah.
And I think in most television shows, he'd write it off and be like, yeah, I just killed that guy. But it legitimately shakes that guy, and you see everyone's vulnerability.
Well, I think that's what the show did. The show did, upended norms. It wasn't a typical TV show. I mean, it's a long time ago now, I mean, we did the pilot 14 years ago.
Oh, my God.
2002.
That's crazy.
Then we waited a year before they started the show proper in August 2003, then we did 3 years. Seems like a lot longer. It seems like we did more shows than we did, because it was a remarkable time for everybody. I mean, it was, everybody got on. Everybody brought their A game. It was a remarkable 3 years of experiencing other actors who just loved being there.
Who was Al to you? Did your relationship with him kind of develop through the three seasons?
Yeah, well, I think it developed through David. I mean, because David writes in a way which they gave him space to at the time, obviously, because we canceled after 3 years. They got a little wary of it. But David tends to write a scene, then sees it played, like most good showrunners do, and then sees where that's leading to, and then doesn't sort of shoot the next bit. He goes back and rewrites. But we were in a very fortunate position, Chris, because at the time when we did it, we were all at the ranch, Gene Autry's ranch up in Santa Clarita, and everybody was there. Everything was there. The writers were there. The sets were there. The extras, the horses were there. So there was no, location. You didn't have to be in three locations a day. He could actually write and say, and editing facilities were there. So everybody was there the entire time. So he could say, let's take an hour. I'm going to change the next scene after lunch. Or I'm going to adjust this, or we'll do this. It only meant crossing the road, because we had two sound stages there. Mm-hmm. So it only meant moving up the street physically for a location, or moving back into a studio. So it was a most perfect way to do a show as I've ever met.
Do you like doing television? Because I think you do Lovejoy for 9 seasons?
No. I had the idea for Lovejoy. I bought the original rights to the books in 85 with a great friend of mine, Alan McEwen. Tracy Ullman's husband, Alan, who my dear friend. And Alan and I did one series for the BBC, but it was one of the first independent shows, because we produced it. Because they said, oh, well, we'll do it. And we said, no, what's the point? We'll do it. We'll produce it. But, you know, we'll do it with you. Give us the money and we'll take care of it. And we did one season. It was very successful. And then a guy called Michael Grade came in, who was he flopped in America, but was one of those cigar-chewing, like, widow boys back in England, became the BBC and said, oh, yeah, this Charlotte will take over. And he'd previously had run-ins with Alan, because Alan was one of those very – Alan, you know, I've known Alan. Alan was a hairdresser the first time I met him on a movie back in – if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium. He was the hairdresser on it, but we became very good friends. He was also Elizabeth Taylor's hairdresser.
Oh, my
that.
God.
But Alan then had always smart. He had his own shops in London, whatever, and he was a business guy, basically. And he then saw television, and he got these two writers called Ian Lafrenet and Dick Clement, who did for a great English series called Porridge, The Likely Lads. And he ran their career, and we were all great friends at the time. And when I found Lovejoy, I said, Ian, I wanted to write it. So Ian, Alan, and I went to England and wrote that. And then Michael Grade, he said to me, Alan said, do you want to do it? He said, because I'll step aside. I said, I don't want to work for fucking BBC. I said, we'll work with the BBC, but not for them. So we waited 4 years, and the guy that commissioned it, Jonathan Powell, was then made overall head. And he came to Alan, me, and we were on other projects, and said, you know, Lovejoy, he said, I always loved that show. He said, would you come back and do it again? This is in 1989. And do it the same way you did before as an independent show. And we said, fine. Then we did 5 years. And we did 72 episodes. Because, you know, England's famous for saying, it's a marvelous show, but we only want to do 4.
Right.
I never understood that concept. You know,
people love it.
Let's do 5 then. And you think, yeah, because you know there's only like eight Fawlty Towers.
Right, yeah.
So there really is only like 8 shows.
Right.
But they're so great. I mean, you watch them and watch them again.
You think it's so much more, yeah.
No, but they're not. So when we did it, I said, well, we want 2 seasons and we want to do 20 at least, 10 shows. And they said, great. And then the first year, they liked it so much, we did a special. So we ended up doing, I think, 75 hours of TV. And we did it from 90 to 94. And then it seemed perfect. And then it's like, as you do when you're exposed like that on television, you then say, right, I'm going to do, you know, I just did voiceovers on TV for a few years and said, because you can't do TV anymore. Everybody goes, it's Lovejoy pretending to be somebody else. Because you're so, right. I mean, those days we were getting like 17 million viewers.
Oh, my God.
Which in the heady days of 92, 93 was pretty good. You know, nowadays they wet their pants if they get 8 million. You know, whatever, but it's a different world. So I just sort of, but it was a great show. Again, we had the wonderful Phyllis Logan, who went on to greater glory as the lady downstairs in Downton Abbey. You know, yeah. She's great, Phyllis. And it was a great show to do. But then it was, and also I directed some of them. It gave me, gave me a background in TV. So I directed the first one every year. So it gave me time to sort of prep it properly for a month. I didn't just come in and say, I'm going to direct this one. It was properly done. And I enjoyed that, and then took a while off, and then David. No, I didn't do any TV between that. I did another 6-part series in 91, sort of a law firm, and then David, and then they came through with Deadwood. Why the hell they didn't find anybody here, I don't know, but thank God they didn't. Sometimes names have got, parts have got your names on them for some reason. They go around, but they finally find the right guy, you know.
Right. Was there an audition process for that? Or did you meet with David?
No, there was. Well, I mean, they'd seen me because, you know, Sexy Beast was out by then. So there was a lot of inquiring about what do you want to do. But no, but Walter Hill, who I knew Walter. We'd never worked together, but I knew him. And they said, HBO said, would you come across an audition? And I met David, and then I then I did an audition for them. I just went in there and, you know, talked to him and blew it out the park.
What's your audition technique? I'm curious to know what Ian McShane's audition technique is.
To go in there is if you know what you're doing, not to wait for them, you know. So I remember I just walked in and said, would you mind if you just stay here? I'm going out of the room again. I'll come and do this. And then to know it and own it. So I just treated them as if, you know, get out of my fucking way while I do this big speech and talk to them about whatever. And said, like, just let me do it. Don't sort of, you know, because there are people reading, you know, with you sometimes. And David just was there. I'd met him and we talked about it. And he just said, you know, and that was it. And then we waited for the word from Chris Albrecht from on high, and it came within like a two hours.
Oh my God!
And that was it. Yeah, so it was good. But what? I mean, that was it. They'd been having trouble with that part. So why I don't know. But luckily, it was.
What do you think the rationale behind British television is, where they only want to do a few episodes here and a few episodes?
I don't
episodes
know.
There?
It's a funny thing. It's this. I don't really know. They don't have syndication in the same way they do here, because this is such a huge country. I mean, that's half of it. When they do TV, they want to get a serious set of you know, episodes so they can sell them to syndication,
right,
and make the money on them. But BBC was like, well, it's certainly nothing to do with quality, because I think, you know, it still goes on. Not so much anymore. They do eight now. But they do. It's literally, they do eight shows. But that's like a big year, you know. But it's like a big thought. Well, we'll do eight, you know. Or we'll see how it goes. But, you know, I mean, nowadays, it's the goal. I mean, it is the golden age of TV now. What have you got? 450 cable shows vying together? I think
there's a lot of really good.
It literally is. Oh, there are a lot of really good stuff.
It's
when
too
people
much
say, do you want to watch that? And you say, I've never. When do you get a chance to see it, you know?
I know. And people who are able to watch everything, I don't know. They must not have jobs. Like, people are like, have you seen this? Have you seen this?
No.
You,
no, I, no time for anything.
I work. I mean, I can catch up as much as I possibly can, but that's not a lot. But I wonder if some of it has to do, because I see the upside and the downside. The upside being, you know, you can really focus on quality for eight episodes. But I also feel like there are certain characters, it would have been nice to see how that developed, or it would have been nice to see where that person was in season three. Usually feels like that's where everyone's firing on all cylinders by the second or third season of a show. And I wonder how many amazing British shows just didn't get that chance to really lock in, because it was just...
They seem now to be more... Well, I mean, they seem now to be more on the BBC and the ITV seem more... in the sort of regular kind of like regular TV vein.
Mm-hmm.
Shows like Call the Midwife, mm-hmm. The 30s, they stick to stock things that work. Well, they do them very well, and God knows I'm not knocking them, but they do them very well. But shows like Happy Valley, did you see that? Which is a sort of a story about a distraught female detective from the north.
No.
So like, it's a really good show, really interesting villain, a complicated home life for the cop, a female cop. The diversities of it, with this very good actress, Sarah Lancashire, and very well written. Peter Morgan's The Queen, they've just done that as a Netflix, which is a very good, apparently. I mean, nothing bores me more than the home life of our own dear Queen, you know. Jesus Christ. Dear God, can you imagine? Get those corgis away from me. You kick that fucking dog. Philip, will you please? You know, all that going on.
Well, I guess it's just people going, oh, they eat breakfast too?
Oh, like, I know. And they did go to the loo. Yes.
Yeah,
they,
exactly. that's what?
It's the only way to make anybody seem, you know, human is to imagine them squatting on the toilet, isn't it? I mean, and then everybody seems to be quite, you know, normal.
But it is such a strange, I mean, I think Americans are so fascinated by that construct.
Well, that's why they've always loved shows like, you know, Upstairs, Downstairs.
Of course.
And then Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
Now you've got your very own, you know, you got your very own guy in there who's sort of the living example of that, you know.
Sure.
You know.
And then, of course, you know, Game of Thrones, which I know you were intimately
familiar. Oh, Game of Thrones, yeah.
Game of Thrones.
That was fun. I was, oh, yes. Oh, the internet went mad when I gave it away. all those poor babies got really upset with themselves.
Didn't you say something like, it's a fucking TV show? Didn't you say like,
no, I said, it's tits and dragons, get over it. Somebody asked me, they said, you know, oh, you're giving too much away. I said, for fuck's sake, it's tits and dragons. What's so big? And I knew HBO didn't care. I mean, it just adds grist to the show. Everybody couldn't wait, you know, to see more of it. No, but everybody gets so precious now about shows. It's like they don't want to give anything away, and you just give little bits away or whatever, and they get, you know, this. I mean, God, they'll have you signing non-disclosure contracts to do everything. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's insane, as if you're going to go on and talk about it. Scripts now come, you know, with your name on them from some obscure independent film. Say, well, we'll get this to you in a day and a half. And it's Dropbox will do. And I, you know, obviously I'm, you know, a Luddite when it comes to. I mean, I could probably use the very first Commodore 64. I'd still be very happy using it. You know what I mean? But apart from it, but it does. It comes in and you go, what the hell do I have to get this? And I call Lisa, who's sitting over there. I say, darling, how do I read the script? Well, it's in your name. You have to go to Dropbox, take it below, sign a non-disclosure. Say no. Tell them no. It's not like tell them no without. I've got me bothered.
How many Ian McShane roles almost happened and didn't because of a password lock?
It's true. And you get bored with doing it. You think, well, this is as boring as this. And when I get to the script, it'll be even more boring, you know.
But you know what's great about that is that I feel like that's sort of a good way to live of. Is this too? Is this seem fun to me? Is it just feel like a headache? It's a headache. I'm not going to do it then. Why would I want a headache?
Well, exactly. You know, it's like with Game of Thrones. They came to me. They said Game of Thrones are interested. I said I don't want to be in a. Don't want to do a series. They said no. It's a one off. I said great. Whatever it is, I know it'll be good because they wouldn't offer you otherwise.
Right.
And I said, my grandkids would kill me if I didn't do it. So I've got to do it. And it was fun. And Rory McCann, who's the Hound, who's a great guy. So we had a great time there in Belfast for a week. But I must say, that location, wow. Belfast is where they make it.
Wow.
And it's HBO Europe. It's not HBO America. Because I said, I'll see all my old English pals, Charlie Dance, Stephen. Oh, no, they're all dead. They killed them all. I said, well, did they ask for a raise? and they wouldn't pay them in English pounds.
Yeah, that's the, you know, that is the alarming thing on television.
Stanislaus Banilausas wants a raise. Kill him. It's like the old, you know, the old run. The old head of HBO goes,
can I just have a little mix of... Oh, no. Damn it.
Maim him.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing now is that it is... There's no security. There's no security anymore because you can't throw your weight around like...
No, I think it's great because Sean died in the very first series.
Yeah.
He?
Yeah.
I mean, that set the sort of template. You're killing off, you know, Ned in the very first series.
The guy that you think is going to be your hero. They're like, oh, there's his head on the thing.
Well, the two guys are great who do it. Because they've never done a TV show before. They've never done a TV series. I mean, one's a novelist and the other one. And I think they had the idea for the show, and I think they made it and then scrapped it and did it all again.
Oh, wow.
But the first pilot of Game of Thrones.
Which was called Tits and Dragons.
Which was called. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it was Dragons and Tits.
Dragons and Tits, yeah. And then they focus group that.
It didn't scan
like,
very well.
No, you know, tits first. Tits first, then the dragons.
That's
those are the order people like to see things in.
Yeah.
Yeah, a dragon. Oh, I thought this was going to be tit. Well, hang on. All right. Well, you should flip the. Okay, but the thing that I love about that show is just the idea that they have this wonderful mechanism in place where everyone has a goal. Like some shows, you know, they have to develop goals throughout the series or every year they have to solve whatever their problem is and they solve and then they come back the next year. But Game of Thrones, you know, everyone's trying to get to that throne. And that's it. And that drives the story from any direction that you always have that to fall back on.
And it looks pretty good.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
It looks amazing. And the guy that I think is the real sort of not create. Well, he is creative genius. Yeah, because he's the guy that organizes the shooting of it. Because, you know, they have two units constantly shooting and they go back and forth. So there's one guy, I forget his name, is producer, he's an English guy, and he's the one that works out. You know, they have one shooting either in Spain or Croatia, wherever their location is, and one shooting permanently in Belfast. And it's how they interlock and have the actors going across and back and forth and interlocking. I think that's the genius of it.
Yeah.
And they make it work that way.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Manchester, mm-hmm. England. Stretford, the home of Manchester United,
yeah,
who my father played for.
Yeah, I read.
It's kind of nice when I go back to school, when I go back to Manchester, because it's not Ian McShane, it's Harry's lad.
Oh, that's sweet.
It's great. I was there 2 weeks ago at the game at Old Trafford, so they all know me as, you know, Harry's kid.
And did you ever play?
Yeah, I played, but I wasn't good enough. I mean, I played with a couple of guys who were. Yeah, when I was like 9 and 10 and played early, and I played with a couple of guys who were really went on to be pros. The difference at 8 and 9 at that level is enormous, you know. And having grown up with it, my dad being a pro, you know, when you're nine, I mean, I wasn't bad. I loved it until, I mean, I quit playing. I used to play here with Rod Stewart and all that lot. And we used to have games in the 70s up at the Coldwater.
Oh, that's amazing.
Coldwater Canyon Fire Station. We'd all be there playing. And then we used to play in Balboa Park when you get the real ethnics variety down there. You get the Venezuela, all the South Americans playing, and all the Europeans in various teams. We used to have them on Balboa Park. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. So it's like a mini World Cup, basically.
Mini World Cup, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was good. But you know, it's a great game. I mean, but the difference is between why it'll never catch on here is because it's kind of still tribal in England, you know. It's real tribal. I mean, it's really like, you know, every team has their own, every town has their own football team.
Right.
I mean, it's not just that you have the Premier League. I mean, how many football teams do you have in this country? NFL, you don't have that many.
I don't know. What are
But the country's so vast. You've got at least 100 teams in England in four different divisions. The Premier League, the First Division, the Second Division, the Third Division, who are all supported crazily by people who live in their local towns.
Oh, right.
And travel up and down the country. But, I mean, that's why here you don't really get people traveling away to football games, you know.
No.
It's too vast anyway.
Yeah, the country's too big.
Too vast.
The country's really big. I'm always jealous of comedians in the UK because they can basically just keep touring in a circle around a landmass the size of California. And here, when we tour here, it's like, you know, oh, you got to go to the East Coast, you know, okay, that's a whole day to get there, you know, but you just hop on a train, you could just do shows all the way around.
Absolutely. And then there's an enormous appetite for it, you know. But, I mean, there are those comics. You know, I love those comics who've never appeared on TV, which you have a lot of those in England, mainly before because they were too rude.
Right, right.
You know, Blue, those comics who played in working man's clubs. Or
right.
Now you've got comics like, I mean, one of the highest paid. He doesn't do TV. Russell Peters.
Russell Peters, great
comic.
Yeah, yeah.
But he never does TV.
Yeah, it's great.
It's kind of great in one way.
It's great if you don't have to. It's really great if you don't have to, but in order to sustain that, you really do have to tour, like...
Yeah, well, he does, nonstop.
Nonstop.
And plays those huge stadiums.
I know.
I mean, that's incredible.
We don't have a lot
Bill Hicks, who appeared on television 120 times, and they took him off 124 times, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Hicks used to go on...
Well, he was purposely just trying to...
He's a great guy.
He was amazing. I mean, he was purposely just fucking with people and, you know... It just
he was huge in England. I mean,
I'm sure he was.
Oh yeah, that's where. Oh, huge. That's where. There's also what's that? What's the great Rich Hall?
Rich Hall, man. Yeah, Rich Hall.
He plays there all the time. Rich, you know, he's a terrific comic, but you don't see him. I mean, they play. He's like a sort of a guest Englishman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then they do all those Edinburgh every year, Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
Where all the comics from all over the world go now.
Yeah, because sometimes what can happen is if you tour in the States. And you're not necessarily as well known. You play for a lot of rooms where the tickets are free, and they're just trying to get people in there to get drunk. And I think for some comedians, they just don't feel like anyone's really listening to them. And there's so much comedy in such a concentrated area over there that it's just more appealing to kind of find your audience and stick.
Well, you have a lot of comedy shows on TV too, you know. I mean, you have like Nevermind the Buzzcocks,
yeah,
which
Jimmy.
I'm sure you'd love. You do stand up, Chris?
I do. Yeah,
you do. Yeah,
I do.
But I mean, you have a lot. But I mean, Nevermind the Buzzcocks, they have that thing with QI with
QI, Stephen,
which
Fry.
Is a very funny show, and they have various. So there's a lot of shows for new talent that comes up there, which doesn't happen here so much. You know?
No, we don't...
They don't encourage that. I mean, you've got, like, Saturday Night Live, but that's a little... I mean, I was... Yes, they come up with some good stuff, but, you know, I mean, they should have retired it a long time ago. I mean, the format... No, I mean, really.
Right.
But it's great for young people coming in.
Right.
But it's sort of become a staple. But that's what you find with... Usually with American TV, actually, they just always go one season too far. one too many.
Well, that's the money part. That's the money part. Yeah, it's like
sometimes you want to go. No, just you know.
And sometimes that does happen where they'll you know a show like Breaking Bad is a perfect example of them going. Nope, it's five seasons.
That was good. That's a great show,
and it's a great show. But what does happen is you know you get to
network. Say we will need. And thank God that you know cable shows have made the sort of Right of the King, which is if you like Milch, like the guy from
Vince Gilligan.
Vince Gilligan, yeah, terrific. Like that show which I started watching the other day, which I'd never seen, and which I was iRobot. Which Jesus, what a good show!
Yeah.
I mean, no, the whole concept.
You mean Mr. Robot?
Mr. Robot. Mr. Robot. No, it's tremendous.
Yeah.
I mean, well conceived, beautifully shot, constructed. I mean, really interesting. I'd never seen it. And you go, well, there's another one I've got to watch. You know?
Yeah.
And you just go through them and through them.
Yeah, well, you know, HBO, I think, was largely, in America anyway, HBO was largely responsible for, because cable used to be a joke. If you were on a cable show in this country in like the 80s.
But I remember we came across when we did Lovejoy, and we were nominated for it used to be the Ace Awards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Cable Ace Awards, I remember, yeah.
In 92, and we all came across, and we were nominated for Best Sort of International Show, Lovejoy, and we came across Alan and I, and we all sat in some, and it was the Ace Cable Awards at some downtown, man, because it was the big earthquake.
Right.
That's like 94.
January 94.
We all came out for that, yeah. And it was scary.
But Cable was able to say, hey, you know what, guys? We can't pay you as much money, but
we'll give you the freedom.
We'll give you the freedom, and it's not going to be this large committee. It'll just be a couple of us kind of making the decisions. We'll keep it simple. And, you know, and guess what happens when you let really smart creative people carry out their vision without a million notes and too much, you know, too much futzing around with it? You get really good stuff. You know, you get really, really, really good stuff.
No, you really do. You really do. I mean, the guy on Mr. Robot.
Sam.
I mean, yes, Sam. Phenomenal. I mean, I watch a couple of episodes. So you're into it before you know it, you've watched like I did with Breaking Bad, because I was never here, I was always working away.
Yeah.
And I remember it was when we did the Hollow Point. I was waiting, the Hollow Point. When we were doing that, I finished it and I came back to LA. I couldn't go to England for 2 weeks. Gwen was there and I was at the beach and I started watching Breaking Bad. I thought, I've never seen it. I thought, I'll save it. And I watched all 5 episodes, 5 years in like a week.
Yeah.
I said, it was great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, and now they just stream it. I mean, they didn't even have streaming then.
No.
Like they do now.
No.
It's like when, what do you call it, come out next year, American Gods. I mean, that's going out
very
on Stars.
Very excited about that.
Were you a fan of the book?
Yeah, well, I know Neil.
You know Neil?
I do
know
Neil.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, and that's
he's amazing. I mean, he's
incredible.
One of those guys.
Incredible.
He's one of those, I mean, when we did comedy, you know, you don't realize he's a god to those people.
Yeah.
Well, I did Coraline. That movie, you know,
I know.
The voiceover for that. But this is, I mean, he's sort of very varied and very prolific, too.
Coraline's one of my favorite animated.
I thought it was beautifully done, didn't you? I really thought Henry did a great job.
Hodgman's in that. Like, that's such a great.
Oh, Hodgman, yeah. John, yeah.
Yeah.
He was very funny.
It's such a great. It's just such a beautiful little movie. You know, such a beautiful movie.
And he used 3D beautifully.
Gorgeous.
You know, that's the art of doing 3D, you know. As opposed to when we did Pirates of the Caribbean, when. You know, well, the cameraman, who I loved it, Darish Wolski, who hated it, say, okay, get the fucking red box out, you know. Okay, put the sword out. And they really hate doing 3D, you know. It's for the sake of it. Get the fucking shot for the fucking red box. Get the sword going to the audience like that. But, you know, Henry in Coraline, I thought about all the flowers, you know. I mean,
yes.
The occasion, so you have that old concept. But most people just like saying, oh, now's when we all go, in the audience, you know. And the audience goes, whoa, and rolls back. But nobody
I've
really
never seen
gives
anyone
a
do that in a 3D audience ever. There's a sword coming into the. No, it's okay. It's pretend.
It's 3D.
Yeah, oh, these glasses. What did I. I mean, it's such a strange.
Oh.
But
when we did the. Oh, that was it. When we did the premiere in the Cannes Festival. And, you know, the audience, when you were not in French, well, you put on your 3D glasses. You imagine all the French. Told to wear glasses, told to do anything at the night. They were like, I refuse to.
This movie is blurry. Movie. Yeah, you got to put the glasses on. You cannot tell me.
It's blue. It's one of those. Just one of those. Another one done in like 143 seconds, whatever. Billy Lynn's full-time walk. What is it? Has he done that in 17,000 frames? Is that why the Star Wars movie didn't look good? What was all that? Remember they did?
Well, were they
overshoot whatever, or
yeah,
it's only seen in IMAX, whatever?
I don't know, but sometimes, you know, when the movies are too 3D or too immersive, I just get motion sick.
Well, I think it happens a lot. I mean, I remember when we were doing Hollow Point, and I went for a Sunday off, and I went to the local. Sort of, I went to, as you do on Sundays in Middle America, you go to the mall.
Right.
You know? Or you go
picture you going to a mall in the middle of America, putting on your ice skates.
You go to the mall and you look at this. And
going
to
Hot Topic and, you know, buying some pop culture t-shirts.
Or as Murray Roman used to say, you know, you go to the library, you look at the book, and it says, he came, they saw he was Jewish, and they killed him. That's the end of the... Then you go to the movies. And I was, you know, and Spider-Man was playing in 12 of the...
Yeah.
12 of the
mm-hmm.
things.
Yeah.
So when I remember sitting at that, and I couldn't take the noise after two.
Right.
Whether it's age, too, man. But it was the noise just loudest, and you just go, what the fuck am I... You know, watching
well,
nothing.
Well, you know, I think part of it now, too, is just the idea of... I mean, people don't need to leave their houses for much anymore. So how do you get people so
you
they
get them
the
by
spectacle?
Doing? Yeah, exactly.
Well, look, it's his three. I mean, 3D really isn't. I can only think of maybe a couple movies where I thought, oh well, they actually really that was very well woven into the story.
That's what I mean. If it comes together as a whole, I'll be interested to see this because Ang Lee is a terrific filmmaker.
Yeah,
I mean, the guy has really made some great movies. So it'll be worth seeing what he's actually done.
Yeah.
This movie. Because he took a chance on, what was his name? And he did Hidden Crouching Dragon, didn't he?
Yeah, Hidden Dragon,
which is great. Beautiful. So it'll be worth seeing what he's done. Anyway.
So basically what you're saying is the Deadwood movie should be in 3D, right?
Oh, no. Don't even go. Oh, back to Deadwood. Wouldn't it be nice if they just said, yeah, go and make it. You know, get the 2 hours. Everybody will be happy. Everybody is satisfied.
Put on the glasses,
and we can finish it. Al's glasses, can you imagine? Yeah.
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 Get the gimp, and then the mop comes into the audience. Whoa!
No, they're putting that thing down my dick. Which is the thing.
Oh,
3D,
my God.
They're pulling out the stones,
oh,
you know.
The
no.
stones. I don't think there was a male... who had a pulse that watched that and didn't like go up on your tiptoes?
A little bit of whoa
when you went on.
I know.
Whoa! Have you ever had kidney stones? Before?
Oh yeah.
Oh, you have.
It's like I had one when I was like, yeah, God, it was. And it is like being kicked in the balls by a 350 pound linebacker.
Oh my God!
No, it's a weird feeling. And then of course you're passing, you don't even know you've had it. But I had the one. I know of a friend of mine who makes them, you know. They do. People make them. So I just say, stop drinking red wine, you know, because that's gravel. It's like people do. They have, it's a regular occurrence, but it's a terrible thing, kidney stones.
Ooh. Yeah, I know. My wife
now
is
they
probably
zap
getting
them.
Them. They just zap them out and break them down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there, do you think there was any, when you realize at 9 years old, well, I'm probably not going to be a football player, like, was your dad cool with that when you're like,
my dad was the greatest guy ever. He was great. He was fantastic. I mean, I never had a row with him. He was a really terrific human being. And he coached when he gave up football. He had a job because in those days, you know, in the 50s, I mean, it wasn't, you know, he had a full-time job. When he left football, he was scouted. He stayed in the Manchester area. And he stayed on as, he worked for a company called Massey Ferguson as personnel, you now call human resources, you mm-hmm. call it. And he stayed at United training, and he used to train, he used to go like coach kids in school, soccer.
Yeah.
So, but he, no, my dad wasn't this kind of forceful guy. No, he wasn't like, you have to do this. He knew he wasn't going to push me into something that I was. And if you're not as good as your dad, my dad was a pro, you know. I mean, you're going to, you know, I don't think talent is genetic, you know, in those forms. Some of it is. It can be physically sometimes. But I don't think, like, acting doesn't run in our family. You know, my mother's not my father. And I certainly didn't when I was, like, it wasn't like the alternative to football. I didn't start making little, you know, theatres. Like a lot of actors do when they say, I always had a yen, you know. I built my little theatres and cut out little people and read. I said, no, I didn't do that. I just liked playing sports, played everything, went out, regular kid. But they just had one teacher at school who did the school play. And he wasn't like the English teacher. He was a guy called Leslie Ryder, and he put on a play. But I was always the kid in my class, like from 11, 12 years old, who they had to read something out. He'd say, you read this out, because for some reason I could make sense of, like, sight reading mm-hmm. instantly. And I must say, when I first did the play, I sort of got on the stage and I thought, oh, this is coming. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know what you're doing. I felt very comfortable.
Yeah.
Uncomfortable, but comfortable.
Right.
Like, you know what this is about. And that's it. So we did a couple of plays. And I think the following year he said, yeah, we're going to do Cyrano de Bergerac next year, and you're going to play Cyrano. I said, fine, you know, whatever, sir. Can I go and play football now? Yeah, carried on. Then we did it. And then he came to my parents and said, Do you realize your son's not bad at this? Have you thought of it as a profession? I certainly hadn't. And he said, maybe we should apply for drama school. So then I thought there was one, the Royal Academy. So I went out with my mom, and I auditioned, and then they came back and they said, yeah, we'll accept you. So I went back the following year, and I was there for a year and a half. And then my best friend at drama school was Johnny Hurt, who was a term ahead of me, John. And John was leaving to do this movie called The Wild and the Willing, and they couldn't find the lead, which was a 19-year-old, stroppy sort of university kid from the north. He said, I think you could play this. And the same agent who had him said, yes. Yeah. So I went out on a Green Line bus, very romantic in those days. You go to, like, coming to a studio here. And they said, yeah, we'd love to. I met them, and they said, we'd love to audition you. Can you get yourself out to Pinewood? Didn't offer me a car. Got out on a bus, and I came back, and we did the audition with an actress who was in the film called Virginia Maskell, who was a big star at the time. Lovely woman. Went back to drama school in the afternoon, said I'd been to the dentist, lied.
Nice.
And the following day, they phoned up and said, you got the part. So I had to go to my teacher and say, you know, sir, I lied. I didn't go to the dentist. I went to do a film test. And he said, well, we might not give you your certificate that says you can act. I mean, have you ever heard a certificate that says you can act?
How about a check?
No, I've had a check.
Say, yeah.
That's exactly.
Kind of a certificate.
Hey, I'm
going
to get a check, sir. Thank
yeah.
you. So that was it. And I went off, and that's, you know, that was what? My goodness, that was 1962.
Oh, wow.
And since then. So we've been doing it since then.
When Jeremy Irons was on just a few weeks ago, actually, and he told the story about John Hurt, that John Hurt would fuck with young actors by making them very aware of their whatever their tool sets were. Like, oh, it's very – I love the way you do this with your voice, you know, to just, like, make them so aware that it kind of, like, you know.
I think that sounds like a Jeremy story to me.
Is that
– I mean, yeah.
Does he like to tell –
I think it's Jeremy that does that rather than John.
And he just puts it off on
while
other
he's
people.
He's putting scarves around the room. Yeah.
I did notice the room got a lot scarfier.
A baby scarf, Jeremy, yeah.
It was, where did all these scarves come? Like, I turned around for a second and it just...
draped
just
everywhere.
Like, it was just like a rainstorm of scarves.
No, John's great. Johnny and I have been friends forever. I mean, it was very funny because he got his knighthood last year.
Oh, he did?
Yes.
Sir John.
They finally got that.
Do you have to tease him about it? Do you tease him about that, or is it?
Fuck me. Of course you did. Jesus God. I mean, can you imagine? I said, now you're now Sir John Hurt, along with all those other sirs, like Sir Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
Sir Lenny Henry. Fuck me. What exalted company you're in now, darling.
No, it is one of those funny things, you know, when knighthood's been.
No, the funny thing is my agent said to me, and this is, we had the same agent, John, who's a well-known English character, who said, darling, I think we may try to push for a knighthood. I said, come on, I'm not the kind of guy. He said, well, you do get a little bit more money, not much, but a little bit more. There's a sir in front of you.
It just gets a little bit.
Just a little bit more.
But does it? Do you get anything else? Do you get special privileges anywhere? Do you get to go to some kind of stonecutters meeting? Or what,
exactly.
What do you get?
No,
it's nothing hilarious. Like that. But of hilarious. Course, if England is ever attacked by a dragon, you are all called to arms.
I'll put the tits on and I'll be there.
Would you want that? I mean, do you know? Are you going to be knighted at some point?
No, I don't think I'm the kind of guy. I'm not that kind of person. I don't fit into that sort of area. And no, it doesn't appeal to me. I'd say no.
Sir Ian is applying the stain stick to his laundry.
Sir Ian. they got Sir McKellen, you know. He's not called Sir Ian.
Oh, that's Sir Ian. Yeah, other Sir Ian.
Serena.
Yeah.
Sir Ian.
There's another. There is another Sir Ian already.
There's loads. It's a weird thing. Some treated Johnny treated it like no. It's funny. I mean, Johnny Hurt was just. It was kind of like his due. He'd been around a long time, like me. But you know, people like Ben Kingsley, mm-hmm. who insists on being called Sir. Mm-hmm. You know, which is a bit of an odd one. You know. As somebody once said, there's a great story from a great comic called, English comic called Kenny Lynch, who once played golf with, and it was Sean Connery, who's an old friend of mine, Sean and the King Constantine of Greece. Mm-hmm. And they were playing golf at Wentworth, the famous story. And before they started, Kenny said, who's a very funny guy, he said, well, so what should I call you? Your Highness, your King, what? And he said, this is the exile, the King of Greece at the time. Yes, call me King. And Kenny, quick as a flash, said, well, I'll tell you what, if the game comes down to a 4-foot putt on the last hole, I'll call you a lucky cunt like I call everybody else. How's that?
Your Majesty?
No. So it's... What do you mean, honestly? Can you, yeah, call me King.
King,
can you,
yes.
Sounds like a dog. Come over here, King.
King.
Grover, get over here. Sit. No, it's a very big... Don't forget, there's a lot of stuff in England about, you know, there is a lot of... my mother, I'm sure, would love me. She'd love it if it was a sir. She'd love it if they said, you know, arise, you know. Well, the people go, oh, Mr. McShane, it's still Mr., not sir. But she'd love it. But I'm not sure. It just doesn't sit well with me. It
right.
just doesn't sit well with a lot. I mean, Finney turned it down. I think Albert turned it down 3 or 4 times. Lots of people have.
Just because it's too much.
Doesn't fit with you.
Right.
Well, it's too much. Like, and what does it mean? It means you're part of them now.
Yeah.
You know, as a part of what you've been trying to avoid your entire life, being part of that lot. You know?
And do you feel like that gives you less freedom in a weird
yeah,
sort of way?
Yeah, it gives you less sort of, well, a lot of people use it and do it. But I mean, but I understand why a lot of people take it as a badge of honor, which is fine. But I think all those awards are always given out like, you know, they should be given to people, lollipop people, people who do good work in the community.
Sure.
Or take care of stuff. And as somebody said, you know, it's not politicians, for fuck's sake, you know, because Billy Connolly once said a great thing. He said, you know, anybody who runs for public office should be immediately disqualified by running.
Right.
It should, you know, you should be like you. We should pick somebody. You look, when you have a group of people, you know who's the guy that should represent you. Doesn't mean he's the smartest. Doesn't mean he's the most talented. There's something about certain people that fits certain roles.
Right.
And usually if you're a group of smart people, you say, no, he's the one that can represent us. I'm the one that can play devil's advocate. You're the one that can do that. And you find groups. When somebody says, it's like that. I want to, you know, I want to lead. I want to be the one at school always said, I'll be in charge of, you know, I'm in charge of lunch.
Right.
I'll give out your, whatever you want, you know.
Well, but you seem pretty... I mean, and I imagine you've been this way always, but you seem pretty centered and pretty, you kind of know what you want. You seem to know who you are. Like, there's no sense about you of, you know, I'm a tortured artist and I was like, get this job, I'll do this job.
No. I think when I got sober, I was remember what.
How many years?
Oh, it's coming up now. God, it's 29 years in January.
Fantastic. Congrats. 13.
Yeah, thank you.
13. I have 13.
13, good. Yeah. God bless.
Yeah. It's good to see the 29.
Phenomenal, yeah. I know we're here this morning. I was early, and I made the car stop at the old place called Coffee Shop, where I used to see people getting sober back in 29 years ago. So I went in there and had a breakfast. It was kind of nice.
Oh, that is nice.
It's kind of like a solo meeting on your own. Kind of good. Where were we?
I was asking you about the being centered thing. You said when you got sober, that was very helpful for you.
I mean, that was, and I always remember it's the lines of, it's what do you call it? It's Flaubert. Flaubert's great line, which a lot of people quote, I know, but it's true. When he said, you know, if you really, I knew when it, like 15 years into my career, like about 10 years in, timing was all wrong. Something was wrong. So I decided to have a fucking good time for the next 15 years until it felt right.
Right.
Until it felt right. But it's true. It's time. You feel, no, it's the parts of, you know, you get. I was always very high functioning, you know. I could always work, you know. I was got well paid, took care of stuff. But it was like, I thought, I'll have a good time. And then when I met the love of my life, my wife now, Gwen, and then I, you know, and after about 6 years, I got proper sober. And then it was like, yeah. And then I remember the Flaubert quote, which is, you know, live your life like a middle-class bourgeoisie and put all craziness into what you do for a living. And if we're lucky enough to do this, like what you do or what I do, which is, you know, basically fuck about to somebody else for most of your life and you get paid very well for it, then pour everything into that and then lead your life quietly. And it's worked out pretty well.
That's fantastic. How do you – I do have an alcoholic brain question for you, though.
Yeah.
Which is – because a lot of people, I get notes from people and they go, how do I start the process? Or how do I, and I always say, well, you know, just get a support structure, whatever your support structure is. Find a meaning, find a therapist, find someone who can help guide you through this process. But it didn't occur to me until about 12 years in that, you know, of course, stopping the thing doesn't just solve the problem. It just sort of clears the table so that you can start to figure out what the problem is. But I find it very interesting that I've started to identify things about my brain where I go, oh, you're just trying to create drama because you're looking for some sort of an emotional spike that drinking used to give you. So how do you kind of fight all of the other trappings of what that is? How do you sort of push that stuff away and stay centered and stay focused and not let that stuff take over?
I think I was given the best advice when I first started, which was go to meetings and don't question anything too much if you can. And be nice to yourself. If you get agitated, don't put yourself in positions to agitate yourself. So now, whatever, or what, you take a hot bath, or you do put scarves around the room, or you light a few candles, and you put yourself in a position that denotes a sort of relaxed attitude. Instead of, put some classical music on. Don't play rock and roll for a while. Play something else. Put yourself in surroundings that are comfortable for you. Put a dressing gown on. Don't wear your tight, skinny jeans all day. You know what I mean? But it's like all those silly things which sound silly, which actually do help.
Yeah.
Or read something. Don't do that for them. Read something else. Read something natural. Don't watch the news late at night.
Oh, my God.
No, really. But that's enough to get you going, you know?
Yeah.
All those kind of obvious things. And also, don't question too much. And I think one of the main reasons why I got lucky is the fact that when somebody said, how did you get sober? I remember after like 9 months or a year, got sober. So how did you do it? I said, I have no idea. I just did what they said. I went to a few as many meetings as I could, right? I didn't drink. I surrounded myself with what I considered was, I didn't go out with my, put myself in positions or places which were awkward. And it's tough. I got lucky. I mean, I think, I really, at the end of the year, sort of thought, wow. Also, you look in the mirror and you think, oh, my eye's gone back in. Oh, yeah. Look at that. I've got two eyes. I've not got a eye. You know, all those things that, and you suddenly feel better.
Yeah.
And it's tough because I know a friend of mine, one of the few people I've known in my life that, I couldn't help, was died of this disease 2 years ago. Close, and nothing could do, and nothing I could do about it. The only time in my life, and this person who I loved dearly as a friend, and would ask me, and I'd say, I was too close to it, but I'd always say something, and they could not get the message. They hated AA, they hated it, and it really struck home. I thought, some people never get it, never get the message, and it's tragic. But they're looking for too much in it. So I always say, it's a simple program. It's not easy, but it is a simple thing.
Right.
And the benefits just come to you more and more and more. But too much is made of it now, and too many people talk about it all that. I've talked too much about it now, because, the anonymity thing is a good thing. Well, it doesn't exist anymore when I got sober, but I'm very grateful.
But it is helpful for people, especially.
Oh,
because,
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, it's helpful for people to hear it because, one of the reasons why I do bring it up consistently on the podcast. And the reason because I feel like any moment, I know there's someone out there who, even if it's one person, they just hear the right thing and the light goes on and they go, oh my God, this is the thing that speaks to me. I guess this is the thing that I was waiting for, but now it makes sense. And now I'm going to do something about it. And so, I probably talk about it too much, but I just feel like it's helpful for people to hear everyone's path or everyone's relationship to it because I know that there's a percentage of people who go, oh my God, Ian said this or Chris said this and that spoke to me. And so then I changed, I was able to take those steps. So that's why I bring it up. It's not to be disrespectful or try to, I gotcha, I'm talking to, it's really just for people that I know, need help. What'd you say?
Oh, no, I was just taking off because I hurt my ear.
Oh, okay. I thought you said, hey.
No.
You okay? Yeah. What'd you do? Well, you should have those headphones on all the time. You need to get outside once in a while. Katie's the most outdoor sportsy person ever. And we force her to sit in here, you know, week after week and listen to these podcasts. But Hollow Point comes out December 16th.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at the trailer on YouTube, and it has a shit ton of views, and people seem to be very excited about it. And well, you're great, and Patrick Wilson's amazing.
Patrick's good. John Leguizamo's terrific. Jim Belushi's great in it. But we do have a very talented Spanish director, Gonzalo Lopez Gallego, who did done a couple of movies before, and I think... This is he's a gem to work with, and we're planning on doing another movie in the next year, set in the Canary Islands. But he's a great director. He's a terrific director, and I saw it last year at the Cabo San Lucas Film Festival. Cabo sounds funny. What an excuse to go down to Cabo San Lucas and have a film festival. But it was, I saw it down there. Yes, I'll stay at Los Ventanas for 4 days.
Well, if I must.
If I must. Anything, somebody's got to do it.
Anything for the craft.
Yep, absolutely. But it's a really good movie. My wife hasn't seen it, and she loved it, she's a pretty good judge. And it's a good modern day sort of film, Western noir.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a good storyline, and it's good.
How do you know when you... What do you feel when you've done, when you're proud of your work?
Like, I think you know when you're doing it, if it's any good. I mean, I've done loads of films I haven't seen.
But you never know how something's going to turn out.
Like, no, you don't know, but you've got a pretty good idea. You've got a good idea mostly about how, especially on movies. TV shows, not so much, because they're complicated. I mean, American Gods is a complicated thing because we've got a lot of, there's a lot of special effects in it, Chris, which they're doing now. And there's a lot of, there's animation in it and the special effects. And it sounds like a great idea. It's difficult because you're creating, like anything with these kind of shows, which are futuristic, come under that fabulist mm-hmm. fantasy kind of heading. You don't want it to be too twee. You don't want them to be too, it's set in the present day. And finding the tone is hugely important. Finding the tone and the look. So I hope they find, I think they found the look for it. Mm-hmm. And the tone will be whatever. I mean, there's 8 episodes, and they're very varied. They're very different. Ricky Whittle's great, the kid who plays Shadow Moon. He's a terrific kid to work with. We have a good rapport. And very good, terrific showrunner. So I worked with before, Michael Green. I did Kings with him.
Oh, okay.
Well, Kings is a classic example of one of those shows that, you know, a network says, we want to do a cable show. Then you do one for them. And they go, you can't say that. I can't do this. And they say, we're putting you out of Saturday night at 10 o'clock. And you say, thank you very much. The death knell for any drama. Saturday night at 10 o'clock.
People
GNBC,
love
thank you.
Staying home on the weekends
absolutely.
To
Can't
watch
wait to see it.
Complicated dramas. They love it.
They love it.
Do you want to go out or should we stay in?
Let's stay home and watch that new, what's it called? Yeah.
King, here, Kings.
Something.
Yeah, it is. It's so funny.
But it was true. But you know, they were all high on it. And of course, you know, and especially when you're into like episode 6 and you've met all Ben Silverman and Catherine Pope and they go, a little bit of news today. Yeah, they've all been fired. The people that promoted the show, and you go, well, the ones coming in are going to be really fucking behind this one.
They're so, because what I know about network is that when people come in, they love to support the projects that they weren't involved with.
They go, we're very much looking forward to your movie next year and putting all our weight behind it.
Oh my
so
God.
We're putting you out on Saturday night at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, and they go, it didn't perform very well. Did you tell anyone about it? No. No, not one commercial? Nah, fuck everyone. Well, you know, it's like, I was watching a nature show once where it's, a new head of the lion pride has come in. The new male, he's defeated the reigning male, comes in and then gruesomely starts killing all of the young. Just walking around and breaking their necks, and you're like, that's network television.
That's network television.
Yeah, new exec comes in and breaks all the necks of the all the shows that are already there, you know. But in the end of the, at the end of the day, do you just sort of feel like, well, you know, I got to work and it was fine?
Well, yeah, that's what I meant. You got to work it, and it's it's on DVD. It lies forever in the DVD Hall of Fame, you know, whatever. But Michael Green did that, and Brian Fuller, the very gifted Brian Fuller, from. What was it show called? Pushing Daisies and Hannibal. Brian's very gig. So the two of them are really interesting pair together. They write quite differently, but when together they're inventive. And I always thought when I read the book, Gaiman, who was around, and Neil's on it as executive producer, that actually the book is like, it's like a blueprint for TV series. If you remember it at all, I don't know. But, you know, it's like, because he leaves a lot out. He just leaves it open there. as how do you do the TV show? And it's the book, because he leaves so many sort of areas uncovered. He jumps around and he has separate stories come into it. It's a very strange book, American Gods. A lot of people love it. You know, they're obsessed by it. And I think we end the first series, assuming that
might be the second.
You never know, Christy.
You don't know.
And you know that Stars wanted to be huge and Fremantle wanted to
be
huge.
Of course they do.
But you never know.
Right.
But I know we ended at a point which, you know, is a very good point, a very good area where you just know, actually you get to know what the show is about. Not sort of halfway through before they all meet at the House on the Rock.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. So the House on the Rock, for those who know, you know what I'm talking about? House on the Rock, that'll be the second year.
Great.
If there's a second year.
Yeah, you just hope that when you're working on something, some executive doesn't come in and go, this is going to be huge. Like, God damn it, why'd you say that?
But they always say that.
They always say that.
This is going to be great, and you're going to be
great. You just never know. What percentage of your year do you like to work and have off?
This year's been a long one. I mean, I did a... I finished off this time last year, we finished off John Wick 2, which
yep.
comes out in January. Then I went and did this rather charming movie with Michael Shannon and Ron Perlman called Pottersville, which is a sort of like a – it's kind of like an It's a Wonderful Life, like a charming American story, which we did in January in upstate New York. That'll be out next year. And then I went to England, did a boxing movie with Ray Winston, me, and a guy called Johnny Harris, who wrote it. Again, Johnny is sober like 5 years, and this is about a boxer who's gone down, slid down the way, and comes back. And that's one of the reasons I did it, because it's about the meetings, it's about our thing. As my mother-in-law said, that thing you're in. My mother-in-law used to say, that thing you're in. I said, yeah, well, it's about that. And, you know.
How's that thing you're in? Well,
it's going pretty well.
Good. Yeah, I think I'm going to stick with it. I'm sick of it. It's going to be
a real
thing.
And then I went off and did, and I got a thing coming out with Dre as well, Dr. Dre.
Nice.
Yeah, Vital Signs will be coming out on iTunes. Me, that'll be good. Me, Sam Rockwell, and Michael K. Williams
mm-hmm.
playing Dre's inside his head, but actually we actually appear with him. But I play Vengeance, Sam plays Ego, and Michael plays Negativity. And it's all about Dre's early. It's about Dre. It's going to come out on, I think it's Beats TV, which is Apple's first kind of attempt at streaming.
Yeah.
Doing drama.
So it's like hip hop Inside beautiful. Out. It sounds
yeah,
like hip hop
yeah,
Inside
Out. It's
kind
of the story of his life. It's like, you know, now I'm this billionaire guy who's out of Compton. Can I trust anybody anymore?
Yeah.
What goes on in actual life? Because that'll be interesting.
And what do you do with your free time when you have free time?
I read a lot. I read. I love watching TV. Watch a lot of shows. Play a lot of music. Travel a lot. My mother's 95 in England, so I'll go back and see her. Yeah, I'll go back and see mom 2-3 times a year.
That's great.
And my wife's mother is also alive. She's 96, so that's where she is now, in Detroit with her. And my kids and my grandkids are in London, so I'll go and see them. Just came back from them 5 weeks in London, sort of seeing them all before they have their holidays and all that. And, busy, and I like to work. I enjoy what I do, you know. I really, really do. And that's part of my, as I said, when I got sober and when, you know, said, yeah, this is what you're meant to do and make the most of it. And there's some fascinating projects and some work out, some don't. But America, I'm looking forward to them all, actually, yeah. But, I mean, Hollow Point is really, because we tried to make it for about 2 years and either with Gonzalo, and then it was sort of, I was going to do it with Tim Oliphant from Deadwood, and
yep.
Tim was, and I couldn't do it, so Tim was doing it on his own, and then you know how things do, they slide.
Right.
They were going to make it in Colombia, then they couldn't make it, it all fell through, and it came together last year with me and Patrick. So we 2 years ago, 2014.
Well, okay, so that comes out December 16th. And I mean, you're one of those guys that whenever you're on screen, it's, you know, it's, and the other guy like that is Michael Shannon. So to hear that you guys are in a thing together.
Yeah, Michael's good. Yeah, he's a good lad. Yeah.
You know, you guys have that thing where it's, so whenever you're on screen, like, I want to watch that guy. Like, I want to know what that guy has to say, you know? And I don't know if that's, you know, I'm sure a lot of it is hard work and talent and doing all that stuff. But I do think there is kind of a, because Michael's a very, kind of a sense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it, but there is something about it. There's just an authentic grounding thing that some people just have. And I'm fascinated by it, and I want to steal it.
James Cagney said it, you know. He was asked for advice. He said, plant your feet, look the other guy in the eyes, say your lines, and try not to fall over the furniture. And if you do that, it's a good start.
Yeah.
You know. Be honest.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for asking me. Please,
oh, my God. I was beyond, you know, when Deb, our booker, was like, I think Ian McShane. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, because I just...
No, it's good.
I'm always still delighted when anyone wants to sit down and chat for an hour, you know, because it can be a lot to ask of someone. If someone's like, really, I got to talk to them for
no,
an hour.
No, I like the format, you see, and I also like radio. I find it more easy than on TV, you know, because on TV you're forced to sort of, that's a difficult format. I remember I did the Jay Leno show once. It was like, you know, coming on after Chris Rock, and you go, what the fuck am I supposed to do? And I love Chris. Chris and I had a great chat, but you go, you know, he's sitting next to you going, bah, 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 and you go, what am I going to come on, tell a joke? I mean, what is it? You know, you're an actor from England. You go on, hello, hi. Yes, I mean, what do you do? I'm an actor, you know. I have many stories to tell you. Yes, Mr. Rock. Well, tell one of them, Englishman. You know what it... But it's a very difficult format, that's it. And now, especially because everybody's like, it's all become like... Nobody, I mean, Carson was the master of that, but it's all changed. It's now, it's sort of games. So this format of like being over, it's a much easier sort of thing. You go back and forth and you chat and you can be profane and you can be a bit off color and you can have a good time. And I appreciate it. And I enjoyed talking to you, Mr. Hardwick.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Sir McShane.
Sirian.
How do you get your laundry so fluffy and white? Sirian.
Clorox.
Oh, delightful. I must write that down.
And Downy. Clorox and Downy.
Clorox and Downy.
Ian McShane, thank you so much for being here. Would you mind taking us out in a classic Al Swearengen style, please?
Hey, enjoy your fucking burrito, you nerdy cocksuckers.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels...
There are murders in all of the books.
...that she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.